This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hi, this is David Asola, and you're listening to Whatever Nevermind.
Welcome to Whatever Nevermind, people, a Cobras and Fire endorsed sidecast. My name is Baco, of course. I just want to give you a little heads up here. We have a special interview, kind of a bonus to this week's Alice in Chains facelift episode. David DeSola is the author of Alice in Chains, The Untold Story. It's one of the only books out there you can find that is this detailed and gives you all kind of the backstory of Alice in Chains. It kind of gives you some of the dirt, no pun intended, without being too, I don't know, nefarious at the same time. It's a very, very fun read if you're a fan of rock biographies as I am. We talk all about the facelift era stuff, and of course we get into Dirt, which is a record coming up further down the list. So I'm going to split the interview up into two parts. Today you're going to hear us talk mainly about the era surrounding facelift. Further on down the list, when we eventually get to the Dirt record, I'll share the other half, which you'll enjoy just as much as this one, if not more. But both halves of the conversation are a really fun chat. Dave was a great guy, gave us a lot of time, and like I said, if you're a fan of rock biographies, this is one of the best about a band that doesn't have a lot written about them. So if you're an Alice in Chains fan and you like rock biographies, you should probably go out and get this right now if you haven't already. Enjoy. Like to welcome to the program David DeSola, author of the Alice in Chains, The Untold Story. This book's been out a while, and it's basically available everywhere. David, thank you for your time, and welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell me a little bit about yourself as far as, like, you don't have a whole lot of rock biographies in your resume here. How did you end up coming to be the author for this book? I guess we'll start there.
It was the summer between first and second year of grad school at Georgetown. I had a summer job of 60 minutes, and I was doing class 2 nights a week. So basically, I had a lot of homework. That's what I'm trying to get at here. So one of those nights where I'm, up late reading whatever, I put on the Dirt album for the first time in years probably, and it kind of just sort of, I rediscovered it. Basically, it's kind of like wow. Right?
Sure.
And so I listened to it, all the way through, start to finish. And when it was over, I was like, it's 2011. Wayne's been dead for a while now. Somebody must have written a book on him or something. So I go on Google, I go on Amazon, I go on all the usual sources, and I find nothing along the lines of what I was looking for. So at that point, I had the utterly insane idea of doing it myself. Besides having a day job and summer school, right? So I finished the summer term, be in summer, my summer gig in 15 minutes, finish my classes, and then I had about 3 or 4 weeks off before the start of the fall term. So at that point, I did my first trip to Seattle. I did my first round of interviews and field research, and then I was like, okay, well, make this, do this book and see what happens. And so, you know, I juggled the book in grad school for pretty much the entire, my entire second year. I finished school, and then I did the book full-time, and, you know, there you go. That's it. But basically, long story short, to answer your question, I was looking for a book that didn't exist, and then I decided to do it myself.
So this is very much a passion project for you, then?
A passion project, a challenge.
Okay.
You know, it was the right place at the right time. You know, I had the skill set. I had the motivation. I had the time. I had the resources, thankfully. And just all these sort of things going on in my life at the same time, and it all just sort of happened to work in my favor. And I was like, okay, I'm going to do this.
Break that down, because I love getting to kind of the more nerdy kind of behind the scenes stuff. When you say the resources, what do you mean?
Well, free time, obviously. I mean, I was doing school and I was doing this. So, I mean, it was a lot of, you know, I had office space, I had, you know, time, and it's okay. Like, you know, I was doing one, I was doing the other. There was a lot of, I did a lot of records requests. I don't know if you noticed the footnotes. Those took time and money. So it's like, you know, what can you learn in any investigative reporting project is if you need any documents requests, any public records requests, get those things in early because they can take, they can take you a few days, they can take you a few months. So ultimately, you know, over the 3 years I was working on this project, I came up with something like 14 or 15 binders. Worth of documents, and you know they'll take up quite a bit of shelf space. Let's put it that way. On top of that, you know, I had a, you know, technology was there. You know, digital recording to do my interviews. You know, I was finding people through social networks, through networking. Like, just as the more I met sources, the more I got more names. Found people through social networks. I found people through the internet, you know, through, you know, whatever. I did, you know, in a perfect world, I would have moved to Seattle to do this book. I couldn't do that.
Okay.
But I did fit in I think 5 trips total in 3 years. Hmm. And I was there for like, you know, a week or so at a time. So it was like, you know, when I was in Oregon, Seattle, I would me do or see or get while I was physically there, because it's like, if I could get an interview on the ground while I was there, it was like, great, let's do it over the phone, you know, worst case scenario, I can always do that. So it was, like I said, it was, you know, time, motivation, energy, resources, ego, those things were key to the mix.
So you had no like advanced budget to do this with? This is really just all on your own dime?
Did it on my own dime, and then I'd never written a book before, so I made the very silly mistake of trying to shop around the book without really knowing what I had at the very beginning, and not surprisingly, I didn't get very many encouraging responses, so I was like, fine, I just decided, okay, well, I'm going to write this thing first and shop it around when it's done or close to being finished. So I'd worked on it after that point. After about 2 years of working on it, I interviewed one of my sources, and the source, after the interview, the source asked me if I had a publisher, and I said, no, I was going to write it and then shop it around. And she's like, well, you know, talk to my literary agents. You might be interested in this. And I said, okay, sure. And, you know, long story short, you know, this person had to pass, but he referred me to one of his colleagues who later became my agent. And, you know, he liked the piece and he shopped it around. And, you know, within a month or so of shopping around, he had an offer. So, it was like, okay, at that point I signed the contract. I'm like, oh crap, it's real. You know, I got 12 months to turn the thing in. But, you know, so it was one of those things where it was just very, sort of fortuitous. I was prepared to go self-publishing route if necessary, but ultimately I didn't have to.
Cool.
So it was, you know, I, like I said, one of the many resources that I was referring to in my earlier responses was, besides time, was money. I was able to self-fund this thing, the entire thing. And I could spend as much or as little as I wanted, depending on what the electric was. And that thing, like I booked a month's stay at the W Hotel in downtown Seattle. But I mean, if I needed, one big expense that I think ultimately saved me a lot of time in the end was hiring a transcription service to log all the interviews. Because if you do a 1 hour interview, it takes you an hour just to listen to it. My experience is usually takes you double that to transcribe it, to do a really good transcription. The longest combined set of interviews I did with one subject was Jim Elmer, Wayne's stepfather.
Okay.
And he clocked in at about, in multiple sessions, he clocked in at about 5.5 hours. So do that math, right? It takes me about, 5.5 hours. It takes you about 11 hours just to transcribe that. No, thank you. I hired a transcription service to do it for me. And, it saved me a lot of time, even though it did drive up my budget, but it was a worthwhile expense in the end. So. Otherwise, I'd probably still be writing it.
Well, you don't have to tell me about transcribing interviews, but yeah, that's an awful lot.
I mean, I did that for years in my career, CNN, 60 Minutes, whatever. I mean, it's one of those thankless parts of journalism, whether it's like a 5-minute interview or like a 1 hour in depth thing for like a documentary or something. So, yeah, it's not fun.
And I should mention, I think the book is killer, and you're not wrong that there wasn't shit for Alice in Chains books out there. The only one I can remember, because I am a fan. I am of both books and Alice in Chains. So this was really pretty much catered to a guy like myself. But there was a book about Mike Starr, but it was so poorly written. It was
terrible. Yeah, it's out of print.
Of course.
I got a copy of it on Amazon for like $80. I'm not proud of it, but I had to.
Well, part of your research.
Exactly. And it wasn't that great. I mean,
it's like a ninth grader who headed the Mike Starr fan club wrote it.
Well, he's a journalist, and the problem is he was a fanboy. He got paid to write this book, and
yeah.
And then he went to a vanity, they went the self-publishing route. And then unfortunately, I'm not going to question the guy's ethics because I wasn't going to speak to him. But, Mike Starr, let's just say he wasn't the most reliable narrator. So I think he just sort of took everything Mike Starr told him in whatever state of,
it's kind of shocking because typically heroin junkies are pretty honest with me.
Well, now that we're on the subject, I'll say this. Mike Starr, Blaine, Demery, anybody who had their issues with that drug, they set me down multiple rabbit holes over the years. Let's put it that way. So that's what I learned. Trust to verify, but for junkies, So it was, trying to get it, but it's like sometimes, I don't know. It's almost like mathematical certainty that, junkies lie, And I learned that the hard way. I'd spent like, days or a week or however long it was trying to find a lead, and I just couldn't check it out. On the other hand, some of them did. So it was just one of those things where there was no absolute rule. But if after a while I couldn't find somebody or anything that would sort of corroborate it, I wouldn't do it. Like, here's one that was true.
Yeah.
Mike Starr told a friend of his that I interviewed about a story that he was in Brazil on that last tour with the band before he got fired. He got withdrawal or something, but he was in a helicopter and opened a door and he flew up outside a helicopter in flight. And so he told his friend of his, and I'm like, that sounds a little far-fetched, but I'm like, okay, fine. One of my key sources was Mike's bass tech, who was there for pretty much from 90 to 96. So from the first Alice tour for Facelift to Unplugged, that was his last show. So he was there for the whole heyday of the band, that classic early period, right? And he stayed on after Mike started laughing at it. So I asked him about this because he was in Brazil for that tour. And I was like, oh, yeah, that happened. I was there. I was there with him.
All right.
So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, some of it is, you know, probably taken to be true. And some of it actually checks out. And, you know, there's no iron rule for it. You just got to, you know, you just got to try and check it and, you know, hope for the best. And sometimes you have to cut your losses, even if you spent, you know, days or weeks, you know, trying to run something down.
Oh, that is one of the things about the book I like a lot, though. I think you do an excellent job of separating verified fact from things that are probably true, but you know, you make it sure that you do a really good job of without boring people, but you do a good job of like, well, this is to the best of this person's recollection, that kind of stuff. It adds a real believable nature to the whole everything you're reading. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, it's also, I mean, if you don't read the introduction I wrote for the book, one thing I've noticed is that, like, you know, it's like 20 or 30 years later when I was writing this. A lot of the people were dead. Yeah. A lot of the people at the time were already dead. So obviously they couldn't speak for themselves. And, you know, with the passage of time, you know, people, you know, getting messed up on drugs and alcohol or people having falling out or whatever, you know, human memory just becomes a very curious thing. And you convince yourself that something is true. You may misremember it. I don't know. One of the more interesting exercises other than that was the story of Wayne's last recording session with Alice in Chains in 1998, when they all met up in a studio in L.A. with Dave Jordan and his crew. Now, I had something like five or six sources in that room. So all Jordan people and I'm trying to remember who it was. Yeah, I think it was all Jerge people and Sean's drum tech. And, you know, and I asked him, you know, Wayne showed up super late, right? Because at that point, his drug use had more or less warped his perception of time. So, I mean, he's in, he's on time, and the other people, he's hours or days late, you know. So, anyway, I asked people, you know, they all sit around there waiting for Lane to show up. And, like, I asked, like, five or six different people that question, and I got five or six different times. It's very, you know, somebody says, like, oh, he showed up at 5, he showed up at 11, he showed up at 3, showed up at 3 in the morning, showed up at, like, you know. I was like, dude, I can't even freaking tell anymore, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they were all there, you know, we just kind of make it more mind-boggling. but, yeah. So it was just one of those things where I just sort of like, well, I just know that sources had varying accounts as to what time he showed up. But yeah, so that's, so, I mean, it's like I said, ultimately, I don't think people are deliberately lying to me. I think that's how they remember it, or at least that's what they think they remember.
Sure.
You know, in my case, I was obviously operating with the benefit of hindsight. I was obviously operating with, you know, the knowledge of other people in some cases. Like, I'd already interviewed them, or I'd already researched the subject, or I'd already gone through archives, like newspaper clippings or magazine clippings or whatever. So I could cross-reference, you know, dates with events and whatever. So, you know, I had to sort of try and referee everything, basically. I had to make sure, you know, what the order and timing and things of events was. And, you know, it's complicated and it can be incredibly frustrating. But, you know, I mean, like I said, it's just because things don't check out or there's some ambiguity or confusion or contradiction there, I don't think it necessarily means that people were lying to me. I just think it's, you know, it's just human nature that, you know, people forget or they misremember things as they get older.
Let me take you back a little bit. How old would you have been then, like, when Facelift or Dirt came out? Like, did you get into Alice in Chains right away? Were you into grunge, that kind of stuff? What's your background with the music?
Okay, so Facelift dropped in August of 1990. At that point, I would have been 11. I was living in Europe at the time. I was living in Holland. And at the time, you know, my sort of main musical sort of influence and sort of source of everything was the European version of MTV, which is basically very similar to the American version, just with British sensibilities, with British hosts, and sort of tailored to British and European audiences. Like there are like some like European bands and British bands and things that were big over there at the time that didn't get the time of day in the States, and vice versa. So I discovered, one show I discovered fairly early on was like 120 minutes, which used to be on at like Sunday night at like midnight. And, you have school on Monday morning, right? But I would sneak out of bed and go watch it for a little while. And a lot of the bands I still listen to today are from that period. So how did I discover Alice in Chains? So I don't remember the brouhaha over Faceless for some reason. I'm not saying I didn't hear it. I'm just saying I just don't remember it. I do remember when Nirvana...
You were 11, come on.
I do remember the brouhaha when Nirvana and Pearl Jam came.
Yeah, both, okay.
Nevermind and 10 came out about a month apart, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
And that was like a year later. And that album, those albums, everybody was listening to it, you know what I mean? So, and then Jump came out like shortly after. So as far as how it was Alice in Chains, it would have been either 120 Minutes or Headbangers Ball or Abuse and Butthead, like one of those shows is how I discovered Alice in Chains back in the day. So,
okay. Well, we going back even a little bit more, because you touch on it in the book, because they came out about a year before everything broke with grunge, and that record really didn't hit. And now, when they were first starting making kind of some noise in Seattle, they were kind of tagged as kind of a pretty typical metal band of the time, opening for bands like Great White and Tesla and that kind of thing in Seattle when they came through town. I got the impression, I just doing this show, listening to that music from the time, I was 21, 20 during that all that stuff happened. It seems like they benefited a lot from not hitting right away. Like if they would have, if Facelift would have taken off right out of the gate, and then a year later Nirvana happens, I think things could have been a little bit different for them. But they really started to get in traction just ahead of Nirvana breaking, and things were starting to kind of shift there. With Man in the Box, I think the video came out early '91 or something like that. But that was kind of when things happened, and then when Nirvana did break. So I don't know. Did you get that impression too? Kind of researching this.
So if I remember, before Alice came out, remember, Alice was the Manic Pixies and Silver at that point, who was also, besides dating and later marrying Chris Cornell, she was also managing Soundgarden.
Right.
So when Alice finished Facelift and they were about to go on that first tour, Soundgarden were coming off of Louder Than Love. And so that was sort of that first sort of hit. I think he got a Grammy nomination. It didn't get a ton of MTV play, but it was really sort of a shot in the arm, and that sort of set the stage for Soundgarden when they went to the studio to do Bad Motorfinger.
Yeah.
Seattle was the ball was already rolling, so to speak. So then Alice in Chains went out. And, we do the Man of the Box video, which is the second single off the record. The first one it got played on like metal stations, but it didn't really sort of have that kind of breakout.
We Die Young.
That Man of the Box did. Right. So.
I don't remember that as a single at all, Dave. I I was kind of paying attention to that, so I was surprised actually reading this book and researching this record to get that information, because you just talked about events that are old. That's my 30 years ago brain, but I really don't recall that.
Yeah,
I mean, I'm not saying it's not true. I'm just like, it clearly didn't make any movement is all.
I mean, and thank God for YouTube, because all those videos were online. I could dig them up and watch them.
Yeah.
One of my sources that I interviewed quite extensively was Rocky Shank, who was this artist and video director who collaborated quite extensively with the band over the years. And so he directed, besides doing the artwork for the records, he directed that video for We Die Young. And so he told me some really interesting stories about that. It was a house in Glendale. It had burned down in a fire. And so it's like the house is like, it's a wreck, and there's like debris and stuff in the swimming pool, whatever. And so they hired this family's, the location from the family, the owner that owned it, so they could shoot the video. And then they're like, okay, well, let's put some of this debris and stuff in the pool, because there are scenes they shot in the swimming pool and things like that. And they're like children's toys and things like that. And all these things that people are like, oh my God, what are you doing? You know? So that was kind of a, you know, that was sort of an interesting, you know, I guess first experience. And again, keep in mind, they weren't famous at that point. He was doing it on a shoestring budget because he liked them.
Yeah.
Same deal with the photo shoot for their album cover. And there's a photo shoot of them. If you look at the inside liner notes of Facelift, there's a photo of them on like this mound of yellow like dust or dirt. It's sulfur. It was at a factory outside of LA or something like that. And so, you know, the wind is shifting, and every so often, like, maybe they all start crying because it's gotten their eyes or whatever. And so, So, anyway, but that photo shoot was from the same, and it's like, I think it's the interior photo of Facelift. And, that's Rafi Shankari right there. So, but as far as back to your original question about, you know, the Man of the Box being a breakout. I think it was the right name or the right place at the right time. I mean, I wrote about one of the chapters in there was about the meeting of the MTV executives where they decided, you know, which new video was going to get this sort of this seal of approval, this buzz bin or whatever.
Yeah, I love that story.
The seal of approval. And
do you remember the other artist?
It was a band called Blue Murder.
Yeah,
Jelly Roll. Before they get top player from either Jelly Roll or Valley of the Kings, one of those two.
Just quick note on that: when we went through the facelift record for this sidecast, I brought that story up from your book because I just can't imagine. I mean, it's down to those two. It seems it's almost like just ridiculous to think, because, you know, I don't know if you know much about Blue Murder, but you got Carmine Appice and John Sykes, two guys who are basically they're old, and they're probably already in their next bands by the time MTV is talking about this. You know, they just move around all the time. They don't really seem like the kind of band that gets in the buzz bin, but love to get that little nugget from your book.
Yeah, and so, you know, apparently, if you look at the video for Man in the Box, it's like so dark and so weird. It's like a black and white sepia tone. There's this weird guy with his eyes sewn shut.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it was just so bizarre. And like, let's just pick something different. That was really their deciding factor. I love that.
You have Lane's treatment for the video in the book, too. That was brilliant. Rainy, drippy barn, farm animals, and babies with eyes shut.
Yeah, Paul Rockley, the director, decided the babies with eyes shut wasn't going to be doable. So they came up with the idea of having this, like, guardian, you know, this guy he knew who kind of looked like Jesus with his eyes shut, acted sort of like a caretaker for the animals who run the barn. So that's the guy you see there. And Lane later got that, you know, the Man of the Box tattooed on his right shoulder blade, if I remember correctly. So but as far as the impact that video had on the band, it was huge. I mean, they were in the middle of a Clash of the Titans tour, which is a strange story in and of itself. You know, three thrash metal bands in Alice in Chains. And, you know, the crowd hated them at first. You know, they did, you know, the Slayer fans are notorious. There's an episode where they were just throwing jugs and beer cans and everything they could throw at them. You know, I think it was at Red Rocks in Colorado, and, you know, literally within a couple of weeks later, I mean, they were the biggest band on that bill, you know, and so, you know, life has a...
I saw that tour.
...way of taking its turn, yeah. Oh, cool. Where'd you go?
I went to it in Minnesota in a place called Shroud Air. It's about an hour north of St. Paul, the Twin Cities there, so... they killed it, man. That was actually my first time. I mean, I think I knew the song Man in the Box, but I really hadn't bought all in. But it wouldn't be long, that's for sure. But I loved the entire day. All four bands kicked ass.
And then so Man in the Box was sort of this big hit of the summer. And then for the fall they get the nod to open for Van Halen. And so right when I think in August or September of 1991, they get their gold record for 500,000 copies sold, which was the first of those Seattle grunge records to reach that mark. And that was also the same month that either Nevermind or 10 came out.
Okay.
So needless to say, it was kind of like they set the bar And then those other guys cleared it.
and Dave Jordan coming in to produce, there's a really good story in the book about that. The story is that Dave was arranged to meet them and see them play in L.A., and it was only like Dave, Rick Rubin, and a couple other people there totally, and Rick Rubin walks out.
Yeah. What might have been?
I wanted to ask you, did you know if Rick was there for, like, to actually scout the band for his own deal, or was he just, like, hanging out?
I didn't interview Rick Rubin. My impression from what I call the Jordan, my interview with Dave Jordan, was that they were both there checking out Alice in Chains, because at that point, they were sort of this hot new band, and the record label, which was CBS at that time, later merged and became Columbia, but CBS was sort of shopping their demo around to like every like hard rock and metal producer in town. Mm-hmm. And I guess Jordan and Rubin were like the only two that showed up.
Oh, and Rick probably wasn't happy with what he saw.
I'm not 100% sure. I'm not 100% sure of that. That's just my impression from, and again, I you have to ask Rick that, but yeah, what might have been. I mean, at that point, Jordan, he'd done a whole bunch of stuff with different bands over the years, but for the intensive purposes of his work with Alice, what they were most excited about, what was most relevant, was that he had done the Jane's Addiction album, Nothing Shopping.
Right.
And I think they had just finished Ritual to Love Ritual. So, I mean, that was the sort of point of reference, because what I was told by Ronnie Champagne, who was Dave's engineer on Facebook, was like, you know, they were all sort of, you know, they were all kids, they were all sort of curious. It was the first time in the studio with a budget and, you know, making an album, and so they're like, you know, wow, what are they doing on this track? You know, what did you guys do on this? Because they were all asking about Jane's Addiction, basically.
Okay, yeah, you bring that up in the book. That's kind of cool. It's weird because those aren't two bands that sound much alike.
Yeah, I thought it was. I think it was. I mean, and then they mentioned it. I may have over dramatized it a little bit, but I think it's in the book. Check in the chapter on the making of Facelift. But that would be where it is.
Sure.
Because it's one of those things where, I mean, Nothing Shocking came out in 1988, and I think Ritual came out in 1990, if I remember correctly. So they were,
sounds right.
They had just finished Ritual. They went into Facelift, and so they had like the early mixes of Ritual, and the Alice guys were listening to it.
Wow,
if I remember correctly, yeah.
You know, one thing that also kind of comes through when we're talking about the recording is that we see a little bit. It's how I read it, but Mike Starr comes off a little bit more naive than the other guys when it comes to stuff. When you tell the story about how he doesn't know how to really properly work his own bass gear, he just kind of turns the knobs up and stuff.
I think he was soft. Yeah, I think he was self-taught as a musician. Well, I mean, I think all of those guys were,
yeah,
to some degree or another. He did. I mean, in terms of the three Alice bands, I would say Seda was the one that was probably had the biggest following, the biggest local success. Like, they won a bunch of Battle of Bands. They recorded demos. They got a song on the Northwest Metal Fest compilation. But they had choreographed moves. They had Pyro. They had all this stuff. So, I mean, he was alive before. He was doing this while he was in high school, I think, if I remember correctly. So Mike, in those respects, I'd say, when Alice formed, he was the guy with the most hands-on experience, interestingly enough. I think what he didn't, this is my personal impression here, but I think what he didn't know until he got in the band and until when you know, it became a business, for example, was how much work it was to be in a band. You know, you have to actually, you have to rehearse. You got to keep writing songs. And, I mean, I don't know, but that was sort of an issue where Jerry was, you know, clearly the, you know, if this band is The Who, Jerry's Pete Townsend, and he's got to write on almost everything. And, you know, when Mike learned, you know, after the hit was success of the first album, that writing songs meant publishing money and meant bigger paychecks, you know, he wanted more, but he just didn't know how to do it. And I think that was, I don't know. I mean, if there's naivete, yeah, I mean, I don't know if it was, I think that might have been one of those things where a lack of formal instruction might have in the long term been a negative. I mean, I don't know the full extent of his musical development, but I mean, you know, if he was self-taught, he had good ear training and whatever, but
he was a great player. I loved him as a player and a performer. It just seemed like when it came to kind of the more of the behind the scenes kind of stuff is where he kind of was out of his element. Yeah. And you know, isn't it during this recording, this record, that they actually put duct tape over the knobs so he won't mess with them?
Yeah.
I mean, anybody who's been in a band had at least one guy on stage who wanted to do that too.
I think they even carved the took a knife or something and they carved the settings into the amp pad, so they knew what to set it at. Yeah.
Oh, so, man. Well, Susan Silver said something to the effect that he was the hardest to rein in, like with money and stuff, right?
Yeah, remember, I think if you look at the credits for that first record, I think Jerry had his fingerprints on most, not all of it. Lane had a couple of writing credits for lyrics, but otherwise I think it was all Cantrell. I think Mike had a credit on, I think it Ain't Like That and Confusion. I think those were the two songs he had a credit on. And I don't know. So, but I know that when he got money, he paid, he bought a car. I can't remember the model, but it's in the book. He bought a car and he paid whatever, $35,000, whatever it was. He paid cash, for this new car. So, I don't know how much other money he was getting from, you know, royalties, or if he had endorsements with Spectre or any other instrument company or whatever. So, but he was thinking of how do I grow this money, how do I make it last or whatever. It was okay, I got to spend it. Now Lane, on the other hand, was exactly the opposite. He was very conservative in how he spent his money. Yes, he splurged on toys and video games and stuff, but he got an account
and heroin.
But he didn't fall into that trap of like, well, I'm a big rock star, I made it now.
Give me Ferraris and a mansion
in Bellevue.
I'm gonna throw a joke at you once in a while, just a heads up. Yeah, I get where you're going. Yeah.
Go for it. Yeah, The story is too dark. The story is too dark not to joke about it.
Hey, you know, a little side note there. Yeah, because heroin comes up a lot when we're talking about grunge. I'm about halfway through the list, and there are times where it's just like, Jesus, fuck. I need to kind of give myself a little break, because you know I want to kind of keep things light and celebrate this music, but man, it does get dark. I wanted to ask another thing about Mike Starr real quick. Now, legend has it, and you do touch on it in the book. I'm just curious if this is one of those stories where you openly admit you're not exactly sure how true it is. I'm just curious what level of corroboration you might have got that Mike Starr actually dropped Andrew Wood off at what would be his last drug buy and eventual overdose. I hope I'm not saying that wrong.
That's what he told Mark Yarn, who's the author of Everything Loves Our Town, and if you read that book.
Yep.
That's where I got that quote. And again, how do you prove a negative, right? That something didn't happen. I mean, am I gonna go CSI, Mike Starr, okay, he dropped him off, whatever. I mean, I couldn't, that's one of those things where I couldn't prove or disprove it, you know what I mean? And it's like sometimes I can. And other times you just have to take it with a grain of salt. That's one of those things where we may never know.
So it's strictly from there, nothing else. I'm sorry, I don't remember exactly when Mike died, or specifically when you started this. When you started the book, would he have still been alive, or would he have already passed?
No, he died. I started the book in like September of 2011, and he died like 6 months earlier.
Okay, all right.
Missed him.
Well, there is a huge ripple effect that because things really hadn't kind of grown to where it eventually would. I don't think it was nationally known. At least I can tell you from my perspective, being in Minnesota, it wasn't. But you get it. You do a great job of tying it all together in the book. When we talk about what Andrew Wood's death actually did, and it really didn't have the effect that it probably should have, which would have been a bit of a wake up call. It was more like the first domino, and it took a while until people started taking a little more seriously. It seems like I'm talking about, of course, overdosing, that kind of deal.
Yeah. And it wasn't just Alice in Chains either. I mean, it was Ian died of a, I think Mark Arm from Mudhoney also dabbled in it. Shannon Poon from Glenn Mellon. Who else?
Lanigan from Screaming Trees.
Lanigan, Screaming Trees, yeah.
His book has some really dark, very open and honest stories of abuse.
I haven't read it yet, but I heard it's maybe too honest.
possibly.
So, I mean, the thing about Andrew's death is, like, he became sort of the Sid Barrett of Seattle, in the sense that, Pink Floyd used, the loss of Sid and his, breakdown and everything, as to inspire their work. How many songs did they write about Sid? And, the whole Wish You Were Here album, obviously. And so, boom, there you go. Alice in Chains kind of cranks out with Wood. And then Camelbox is Far Behind. And then, Cornell, starts writing these songs that become Temple of the Dog and yada, yada, yada. He's one of those sort of larger-than-life figures. And, you can't help but wonder what might have been.
Yeah, and I love Mother Love Bone, but I just didn't see, like, when I listened to it, which was posthumous, it doesn't come across as this thing that has that mass appeal that these other bands did. Now, who knows what would have happened? I might feel differently if they had a chance to break, but man,
Eddie Vedder would still be pumping gas in San Diego.
Oh yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, so we got one of those great, what if. Those great cosmic questions that you will never know what everyone might have done.
No doubt. Here's another great
what if. If you ever read Duff McKagan's memoir, he left Seattle. He came up with the Seattle's punk scene. He played in his bands, performed in the Metropolis and whatever. And I think in 1985, or whatever, he leaves for LA, and then he starts Guns N' Roses, right? And so it's funny. So Duff takes off. And then Grunge takes off a couple of years later, but he remembered him staying or writing somewhere that he always wondered what might have been if he had stayed. Like, maybe he would have wound up in Soundgarden. He wondered why.
No, I wonder.
Think about that. What might have been.
It was a very tight community there. I mean, every record I go forward, there's like a half a dozen names that come up constantly on this list, people that have worked.
Yeah.
I mean, like you mentioned, Susan Silver managing some of these bands. Jack Endino produced a bunch of the artists on this list. Sub Pop Records was, of course, involved in a lot of the CZ Records. There's just so many layers to these things where, Matt Cameron has been in about 10 of these bands.
It was a very small circle, just a bunch of people who were playing music for themselves and their friends. And and I think if you look at those early grunge records, those from say like 85 to like up to and I didn't even include Nevermind in that list, there is an innocence and I think an integrity to all those records, just because there were no expectations of fame or success or fortune or whatever. They were doing it for themselves. It was what they liked. It was what their audience liked. And it developed very organically and very far away from the corrupting influence of the industry. Right.
Yeah.
And, so by the time that these guys are all going supernova, right? If you look at that timeline right there, and you look at, Facelift, Nevermind, 10, Bad Motor Finger, Dirge, it's like they're boom, 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 they're cranking out one after the other, and you add, Smashing Pumpkins and Hole and all these other sort of grunge contemporary band.
Stone Temple Pilots.
And it's just like, you're just like, wow. You know, there's just this, it just seems like every like 6 weeks or something, somebody was dropping a masterpiece, you know what I mean? And, but especially for that actual Seattle community, that little tight-knit thing. And then, you know, I guess, you know, once that cat got out of the bag, I mean, you know, the best analogy I've heard, Alex explained that was, it was like sort of like California after the gold rush. You know, everybody was coming over, everybody's coming to Seattle.
then it's the music industry at that point. Well, you know, another thing too about all that is that, like, they would actually do, like, collaborative side projects that were good. You know what I mean? Like Mad Season and Temple of the Dog. It's just, and it just seemed like the reason for doing all these things was effortless and pure. It wasn't like about some kind of commercialization. Of course, I'm being a little probably, I don't know, Pollyannic about that, but.
Well, no, Temple of the Dog for sure. I mean, like I said, it was meant to be a tribute to Andy Wood. And it didn't sound like Soundgarden, and so
and that had that was a slow grow too. That was out quite a bit before Hunger Strike hit.
Well, yeah, because at that point, Pearl Jam and Soundgarden had blown up, and then like the label realized, like, "Holy shit, I got this record. We got this record of like the Soundgarden guys and the Pearl Jam guys together. Let's do talking shit, you know?"
Yeah,
and there you go. So it was like one of those things where it had this little diamond in the rough, and they didn't realize it until, you know, a year later, and. But as far as Mad Season goes, I mean, remember that started with McCready in rehab in Minnesota, where he meets Baker Saunders, and, you know, he comes up with this idea, and he wants to, you know, sort of lead by example and, you know, being sober and whatever, and he wants to help Wayne get sober, you know what I mean? So it started with, I wouldn't say it started with good intentions, but it certainly wasn't innocent intentions in that respect, you know what I mean?
Right.
So they were,
Because it seems clear that Lane needed help pretty early on in the recording, and the fact they kind of plowed through it. I guess you got a pretty good point there.
I don't know. I mean, my personal view on Lane's drug use is, I think that he had over, you know, since he was like a teenager until he was an adult, he was pretty, I guess, strong tolerance for stuff like alcohol or drugs or whatever, and it just didn't affect him, whatever. And then, for whatever reason, once he tried heroin, that was it.
And you mentioned that the Van Halen tour in 91 there, at the end of the facelift cycle, that supposedly was when, what's her name? Is it Demery? Is that how you pronounce it?
Demery.
So that's when she would have, supposedly the first time she, you know, had Lane try heroin. I'm not phrasing that right. I'm not trying to blame somebody, but she was like the conduit to his first exposure, I guess.
That's that story came from Johnny Bacolus, who was, in addition to being in Lane's previous band, in the Grand band, you know, Sleeve, Now Thing Change, he's also his roommate at the time of the Mad Season record. So they lived together for about a year, 15 months, give or take. Yeah. And so, you know, they had been friends since they were teenagers, right? So they're like 15, 16, right? And so, you know, when they were living together, he asked him, you know, how'd you get started on this? And that's the story that Lane told him. And, you know, the fact that, you know, it was in that particular context, it was one of his closest childhood friends, and it was a private conversation between the two of them, that would incline me to think that he was telling the truth.
Wow.
So, I mean, and again, I don't think, and as far as the blame, because I addressed that in the book right there. I mean, you know, Lane was no saint. I mean,
That's kind of what I was trying to say. Is it?
He had been battling drugs for years. I mean, the stuff that I was able to find was, you know, marijuana, cocaine, acid, and I think probably mushrooms, if I remember correctly. That's just the stuff that we knew about. You know, and the other thing to keep in mind also is that when he was still at the Music Bank, and at some point in 1988, one of the other musicians there offered him and another guy heroin, and they both turned him down.
Okay.
So, I mean, it was an interesting, and I asked him that, that story was known to other people who worked at the Music Bank or who were around that team at the time. And so, you know, for whatever reason, in 1988, 88, despite, you know, having, you know, dabbled in other drugs, you know, Wayne knew that he was going to draw the line at heroin. Like, nope, I'm not going to try it. And then 3 years later, for whatever reason, he tries it, and I have not been able to determine why he changed his mind, why he decided to do it. The other thing I would say as well is that even if it hadn't been Demery, you know, there's no way to prove this. This is pure speculation. This is a pure what if. But you know, my personal view is that if Demery hadn't introduced him to it at that point, it would have been somebody else. You know, it was there, and it was endemic to the scene. You know, it could have been, you know, anybody from another band. It could have been, you know, a mutual dealer. Who knows? But it just, you know.
And there might be the reason that he eventually tried it years later, even though he once thought that's just the one taboo, is that it was just becoming too common in the scene that he was in, you know?
Possibly. I mean, you'll remember that, you know, Demery had she was sort of seeing a guy while Lane was on tour. This is another musician who was also a heroin addict.
Yeah, what was his name? I'm sorry, that comes up in the book, too.
So the guy's name is Dwayne Lance Bodenheimer.
And he was in a local band still at the time, and he was just kind of, I don't know, grinding on Demery when Lane was on the road.
I guess so. I mean, keep in mind, Lane was having his fun as well.
Yeah, of course, like, yeah.
You know, he had much moral ground to claim in that argument either. You know, he denied it, but Lane heard enough. And so what happened was at the single shoot in the spring of 91, you know, Alice in Chains is filming their scene. The Cameron Crowe's people have built a makeshift stage by the pier. It's not an actual club. It's just something that they built just for the movie and took it down. And so when they were shooting that scene, and it was like an all-night shoot or something, you know, just doing take after take after take. And so Bodenheimer was there, and I'm looking at my book right now. And so, you know, Lane had Bodenheimer, and then he sort of just confronted him. And, you know, he just, you know, man, just let him have it, you know. And he said, and I'm quoting, this is the quote I have in my book, I'm reading it right now. Quote, "You're a piece of shit. It should have been you that died instead of Andy Wood. I fucking hate you."
Nice.
Now, obviously, at that point, he knew that Bodenheimer was a heroin user. It was like a year after Andy Wood had died. Obviously, he hadn't dabbled in it yet because obviously he felt like he had some sort of moral, I don't know, authority or something to
Well, he's anger and lashing out. You know, I think he's probably
angry. Yeah. And so, in Bodenheimer, what he told me was, Lane said it to me, and that was very hurtful. It hurt me. It wasn't like a total dick. I did have feelings. I felt bad about what was going on, but I couldn't help it because I really did love her. So, I mean, for whatever reason, at some point, you know, even, you know, a couple of months before that Van Halen tour, I mean, he's acting, you know, he's talking pretty high and mighty to this guy about his heroin problem, and then he tries it himself.
Oh, I gotcha.
So, I mean, why he decided to try it after all that, I have no idea.
I really appreciate you tying in that timeline there from that argument to the Van Halen thing.
This was March of 91 shoot, and the Van Halen tour was like August.
Right.
So like 5 months later.
I was surprised reading your book that Andrew Wood actually lived for a little bit after his OD, and all these people like Chris Cornell came back to see him in the hospital. A heartbreaking, I don't know, couple pages in the book.
Yeah, I put together that account from a couple of other grunge books. So it was like the Pearl Jam 20 book. It was Mark Yarm, Greg Prado's Histories of the Grunge Scene. And then there's a great documentary about Andrew Wood called Malfunction.
Ah, I loved it.
Story by a guy named Scott Barber. Yeah. So I kind of sort of put it together from all those accounts, right? So, I guess he was alive in the sense that he had a pulse or whatever, but I don't think he was conscious. I mean, he was on a ventilator, he was on tubes. I mean, he was in a medical induced coma, if I remember correctly.
Right.
So, I mean, and I guess at a certain point, they just decided that it was just too much, and you know, the best thing to do would have been to pull the plug, and that's ultimately what happened. But, yeah, it was just a sad scene. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine what it must have been like being in that hospital. That's drug overdose for you.
Yeah.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more Fantasy Points.